From SDPB Radio, I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to In the Moment. And welcome to this week's Arts and Lifestyle Podcast. Lori Walsh has spent the better part of this week out in the Black Hills to join in the celebration of the Festival of Books. But before we jump into her interviews with the authors, we'll first take a listen to her interview with South Dakota musician Kenny Putnam.
Kenny, thanks for coming.
Well, thanks for having me.
So how long has, tell me a little bit about how often you put out new music.
Oh, it's decades. It's like, I had a CD out probably 15 years ago, maybe, which I sold out of, and I thought I'd make more, or maybe reprint, and I didn't. And then I was on a whole bunch of CDs, everybody else's, and I didn't have one of my own. So I wanted to get back in the studio, and I wanted to do an instrumental album. The first one was, what I do is I play with different bands, vocalists, that kind of thing. So it was me with a bunch of other artists on my CD. But this one I wanted to feature just as an instrumental album, but it does have one vocal number on it. So
the people coming up to you all the time and asking to get the, you know, like, where can I get that CD? When's another CD? Like, how do people interact with you as a musician now?
It's been gone so long, people don't even know it's there. However, one thing, it's kind of mercenary, but I'm the only one with no merch on the table. You know, we play these things, and I don't have anything. I'm represented on, but I didn't have anything on the table, which I thought is an opportunity to, you know, get out some of the things that I do, as well as just helps to have something on the table.
Yeah.
So
people like that.
Well, I hope they like it.
I'm pretty excited. You know, when you said, I was surprised, because I think I saw it on Facebook at first, that you were going to release something. And then it was like, ooh.
You
sort of clench your fists and
You say, I'm doing a solo CD, and they go, really? Are there any other players on it? You know? And I said, of course there are, but yeah.
So how do you approach the whole project then? Do you think about a narrative? Do you think about certain songs? Like, how do you kind of get your mind around something, especially because it's been a while?
There were songs that I always wanted to do, and so it took me a while to figure out what it was that I wanted to do, and a lot of the songs, most of the songs on there I don't do in performance, but they were, there's an old ballad from Cat Ballou, the old Western, comedy Western, Lee Marvin, anyway. There's this beautiful old ballad that Nat King Cole sang in that movie, and I love that song. And so we did I did an arrangement of that, and they called Odd Numbers because there's odd numbers. I'm doing Low Rider from War, which is a odd number, and then the Hawaiian War Chant, which we've done in the Fiddles and Friends program, and also Goodbye Liza Jane, which we did in that show. So I just did all the parts, and then some of the others. There's a beautiful old Mexican ballad that I loved, and then just some fiddle tunes and a jazz tune, and I just wanted to make something that I hope people would listen to more than once. You know, they give you a record, or you go, oh, thanks, and then you never listen to it. Or you're afraid to say, I don't want it, or I probably won't listen to it here.
You're a very humble person, Kenny, but I don't think that's really going to happen.
No,
I hate to.
Well, but seriously, somebody gives you something and you don't necessarily, some people don't even have CD players anymore.
True, yeah. True. All right, let's hear a little bit. You mentioned Goodbye Liza Jane. Here's a little bit of Goodbye Liza Jane from Kenny Putnam's Odd Numbers.
Thank you.
tell me a little bit about being in the studio and working with, you know, because you spend so much time on the stage and this really organic sort of free-flowing, you know, and now you're in the studio and you have a different, maybe, do you have a different goal?
Oh, well, not goal necessarily. I want it to sound fresh and alive and energetic, but it'd be like, and I'm, you know, that's, I'm not that guy that, you know, it's like they pulled me off stage and put me in a closet and shut the door. And that's basically what the studio is. It's you're in a acoustically dead room, and you're looking at a microphone instead of the other players. And I look at other players for cues, for the, you know, conversation of music, and so I'm isolated, and I just have to listen and they react to what I hear as opposed to what I see, and it's very forensic, you know, like let's do this little bit. Right. And, you know, there's a lot of fuss in which, you know, is necessary in the studio, in the mix, and I did it with Chris Gage down in Austin. He has a Moonhouse Studios down there, and he's responsible for kind of what it sounds like, because there was a lot of overdubbing and tuning and fixing and putting people together and that kind of thing. So I give him a lot of the credit for what it sounds like. But the whole exercise of recording is, some people love it and some people don't, and I'd rather just, you know, play it and let it float in the air instead of, you know, fuss over it. So,
but you can embrace the fussing.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess I like.
Do you endure the fussing?
You have to. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
here's a little bit more from Odd Numbers, and this is called Honeysuckle Rose. So happy that you can take this home.
Oh, well.
Because don't you think, I mean, I'm going to be dancing in my kitchen.
Well, good. That's good. Yeah.
That's, you know, one of the things I just find so fascinating about you and so many of the musicians that you work with, and I think you get this, is just how much you are part of people's lives and how deeply personal that is, because they, you know, they've seen you and had an experience with you and you know, can bring that experience home as well. That's a great privilege, and you've done good things with it.
Yeah, and, you know, music becomes part of people's lives in a way that if you heard a song when you were a child, like a Christmas song, that song will resonate your whole life when you hear it again. You know, people with memory loss, they hear music that they heard in the past, and it just activates their brain and their emotions, and so music has that power, and to be able to do it is a gift, you know, not a, like a gift, but it's a, it's an appreciated gift that I can do, that
means something to me as well, you know, and so it's, and I really think that a lot of people, like your writers, everybody needs to have an expression or an able to express themselves in some way or another. And I think most people don't get that opportunity. They could write, they could draw, they could play music, even for their own amazement.
Yeah.
But they need that expressive tool to be fulfilled in a way, and some people don't allow themselves to do that. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was just something I did for a living, and it was just, you know.
What would you have done if you couldn't have done this?
I wanted to paint. I wanted to be an artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I went to school for. This music was, I always say it was a distraction because I'd pursue that and then I'd get a gig and go on the road. So, yeah.
Hawaiian war chant.
Yeah.
We're going to hear a little bit of that, but first tell me a little bit about the background of this piece.
It's a great piece that I've been wanting to do forever, and I finally talked Fiddles and Friends into doing it. And I always say that, my roots are Lawrence Welk. You know, I'm not like an old, like Cajun or blues or all that Tennessee. I grew up listening to Lawrence Welk, you know, white bread, middle America. They had Hawaiian War Chant on their show and they did a great, so I use that as my arrangement basically. And
where does it come from? Prince William Ped Leleohoku III.
Yeah, he was a...
The second.
Yeah, he was a Hawaiian king prince, mm-hmm. He wrote the song long time ago, and it's been recorded by, you know, Buddy Rich and a bunch of people, but it's a great song.
Let's hear a bit.
And it's on my octave violin, my low, between a viola and a cello.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so.
All right, let's hear an excerpt.
Let's hear from some of the authors. Up first, the 2019 Young Readers One Book South Dakota author, Don Montalo.
Sitting across from the table now, Don Montalo, who is the 2019 Young Readers One Book South Dakota author. And I have to say, Don, it was just such a thrill when this was announced. So many people were, because the Young Readers book is going to go to, they make a special printing,
right.
And they give it to every third grader?
Well, we give it to every second grader last year, and there was 10,000 of them.
Wow.
They give it away.
Yeah.
Free.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's really remarkable about this book is that you cannot purchase this book. Mm-hmm. They only give it to the second graders. So there are so many people that come to me and they say, where can I buy this book? And I'm going to say, go back to second grade.
Find a second grader that you like and hang out with them and read it with them.
Yeah.
It's three books in one, and that's sort of the reason why it's not available in a regular bookstore. You can buy the individual hardcover picture books, which I think a lot of people know and love in the state of South Dakota. This edition puts everything into really a backpack size paperback.
Yeah.
Lovely.
And I think that's
lovely
why
version.
We wanted to do it too, is because it would be put in a backpack for the children themselves, you know. So
it's going to take a beating.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I hope it's all beat up and read thousands of times, you know. So
right, this is exceptional as well. I think it's the first young book for readers that also is in Lakota.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about. Providing English and Lakota in the stories for all kids, and really how powerful that can be.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what made it unique, is that it was in English and Lakota both. And I really had a hard time finding somebody who was fluent and wrote Lakota in right. South Dakota. And I found Agnes Gay. She was the assistant archivist at the Oglala Lakota College at Kyle. And she's just a tremendous lady. She's nice and quiet and shy, and unlike I am, loud and bold. But she really is the one that made it exceptionally different from anything else that you read on the bookshelves.
Yeah.
What we've done is wherever I try to present the book to the second graders last year and now the third graders during the book festival, is I try to find a Lakota person mm-hmm. who can read with me. So I read the English part and they read the Lakota part. Yeah. And it just gives the whole book just a certain zing. It just adds an element that you don't find any other place.
You are an author and an artist. These illustrations are all yours, correct?
Yes.
In these books.
Yeah, they all are.
How did you get started as an illustrator? And do you see those as two different words, illustrated and what's that?
Hunger.
Hunger? Hunger and talent coming together.
You know, I had a unique opportunity because the South Dakota Historical Society, they're the ones that published this book as well as my other books. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for illustrators, and I happened to be at the right place at the right time, which so many of us artists are. And they actually wanted to pay you, so that was even better.
Important.
And the first book that I did was Tatanka, and I didn't write that book. It's a traditional story written by a lot of Lakota elders. And I was asked to do the pictures for it and for a film loop. That's how it originally started out, was a film loop for the museum. But there was such a demand for the written script that they decided to do a book.
Really?
And that's why then they had to go back to the Lakota translators and find them, and some had passed away, so they had another difficulty trying to condense that large story of how we evolved from Mother Earth up to the surface. And they wanted it very simple. It was really cool. Because they said, we want these drawings real simple, but you can only use four colors. I thought, what do you mean? Out of four colors, I can make the whole palette, you know.
So. Yeah.
But they thought they was limiting me, but they didn't.
They were not.
But very simple. They had some very stringent rules on how they wanted it, what size they wanted it. And I fulfilled them. And then I asked them one day, I says, you know, how much do I get for doing illustrations? And they said, well, you get a nickel on a dollar. Wow. And I said, well, how about if I illustrated it and wrote it, how much would I get? And they said, a quarter on a dollar. And I thought, that's good math to me. So that's what I did.
And now I'm a writer.
Now I'm a writer. And mm-hmm. and it was really crazy because I have a hard time being an artist all my life. Yeah. And now the last probably 8 years becoming an author as well, too. So.
Right. This is a combination of, there's a lot of things converging here, oral history, story, culture, a physical book that kids can take home, kids who might not have a book in their house. I'm wondering, from your childhood, what was the role of books, physical books, versus oral history versus stories?
Well, I grew up in the 50s, so we didn't have a television.
Right.
And we didn't have no cell phones.
Right.
You know, we had books that we actually read, you know. But the one fun books that we all read was comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, of course, there was Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and Goofy and the boys, you know. And so my father, in order to entertain me, would buy me comic books. But then he started drawing because my father was a good artist. And I'm the only child, so I had a lot of time spent at the table, the kitchen table. And I would draw, and I just fell in love with Mickey Mouse because he was easy to draw. All he is circles, you know. So you can draw Mickey Mouse pretty easy.
And then how did you you know, contemplate as you told this story, sort of looking back, and you say in the end notes, you know, in this first story, and you know, there's sort of inspired by Buffalo Hyde paintings, and then the next is inspired by Ledger art, and and so on. So how did you get to that point?
Well, Herman Redauch, who was my mentor, he was the one that really inspired me, and Oscar Howe, who was a real well-known artist, they were my inspirations. And I always wanted to be Oscar Howe because he was all the things I wanted to be. He was an artist, he was a family man, and he was a professor of fine arts. That if I could achieve those three things in my life, I would be successful. Yeah. And then I met Herman Redauch, and I thought, well, wait now, if I could be a traditional person and then speak Lakota fluently and know all about the tales that we have in our culture, maybe I'll be a successful man. So they really did it all. And then my father, he kind of pulled it all together because I learned how to draw from him.
Yeah.
And so those three people were really my inspirations. And through those stories, oh, if you're a good illustrator, you read the story about 100 times, and then you start sketching, and you start feeling something inside you that's trying to portray those words that author's writing down.
Yeah.
You try to showcase those words into a picture. And the last one, especially on this right here, is Muskrat and Skunk, and he's a wild boy. It's something that's probably like Kenny was just here a little while ago, and he's a fiddle player. Well, this guy plays the drum, so I really got this. And then Skunk shows up too, and they both start beating in the hollow log, and eventually they get a rhythm going,
yeah,
which is the heartbeat of Mother Earth, who is the essence of our drum. And then that is powwows, and other things grow from that. So
second graders must love this story in particular.
Yeah.
And if you haven't read this story, you know, the animals come, and it really, by the end, they're dancing on their hind legs, and you know, the buffalo's having a hard time because he's really not built, you know, for this.
Right.
And he's silly and wonderful and joyful. All these things are happening at once.
Yeah.
What has some of the response been from those kids,
you know,
especially
when
about this story?
Yeah, when I read the story to them, it's like boom, 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 bam, 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 bang, bang, bang. It's sound effects.
Nice.
And so I let the children, since they're really bold on this page, I let the children say those words as I'm reading. And a lot of them get caught up, and I'll have boom, boom, boom 4 times, and they'll go boom, 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 boom. And I go, wait, now hold up, back up. You know, there's only 4 boom booms, you know. And they just relate to it so much, you know,
right,
because they can dance with it, you know, because there's dance and there's noise, and you can be wild and crazy. But there's also a part in the story too where they wake up Bear from so much noise, and he's taking a nap, and he comes out, and of course Bear's big, and he chases them all away, because they see him and they run away. But then Bear comes out and he's dancing. He's standing upright, bold, and he's just taking care of the rhythm. And they all come back and rejoin him.
Yeah.
So in that essence, what it's saying is that Bear is our elders. Bear is our leader of our grand entries to our powwows.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the other people behind are the various ones, the traditional dancers, the fancy dancers, the shawl dancers. They're all behind Bear, because the safest place to be is behind Bear, not in front of a Bear. But that translates into how we do our grand entries into the powwow.
There are so many children who this will be their first Lakota story, the first time they hear the word Lakota, the first time they realize there's a language, the first time they maybe don't know what a powwow is. Maybe if they heard the drum, they would have a connection to it. That's a pretty powerful thing for the one book, South Dakota.
Yeah. What's really nice about this, too, in 5 days, is the powwow is going to be in right here at the Rushmore Plaza Civic Center in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Oh.
So it's really kind of a nicely timed event with the Black Hills Book Festival.
Uh-huh.
You know, 4 days later, bang, here's the Black Hills powwow. And I've told them about the book and everything. So the transition would be wonderful for them to actually come down and see the powwow.
Right.
And then hearing the Lakota in my presentations, they really have a real nice feel of a culture that's not theirs. But it's not Hollywood either. It's not scary, it's friendly, it's something that's really gonna let them enjoy another culture.
Up next, as we continue to celebrate children's literature, Rebecca Swift and Sean Covell. They are the authors of Porter the Hoarder.
With me now, we have Rebecca Swift and Sean Covell, authors of Porter the Hoarder, which, if you live in South Dakota, you have probably already heard about. You have definitely heard that Sean is the producer of Napoleon Dynamite, and that gets everybody's attention. And Porter is maybe not your typical... I mentioned good books for bad children earlier. She might fit in that category. She's not necessarily the most well-behaved, classic.
Anne true.
Of Green Gables, we are not.
That's true. And now for something completely different. Yes.
I want to talk so much because this is not just a series of books, but it is a project. It is a reading initiative as mm-hmm. well.
Yes.
But let's start with Porter herself.
Great.
Sean, kick us off.
So Rebecca created Porter the Hoarder. And actually, where did Porter come from? You want to talk about that?
Sure. Yes, my daughter Logan, who's 15 now, when she was a little girl, we ran a tight ship and her room was mostly clean. But I opened a drawer and inside we found candy and wrappers. And, you know, it was from Halloween and Christmas and Valentine's Day, and this was the following March. And I thought, oh no, I have a little hoarder. And I immediately drew a picture of a little girl with pigtails, and she had a pretty sweet personality back then. And I had met Sean through a project, and he gave her a voice.
When I saw the design, which you can see is very, very simple. It's a lot like Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, and
right.
it's simplicity. I saw what she did with that, and then I saw how Rebecca could change facial features very simply and create so much emotion out of this character that it all kind of snapped into place. Kind of an obnoxious little girl, sort of a female Eric Cartman, who in book one refuses to clean her room. And the room is just piled with stuff, and so the book opens with her mom coming in and saying, hey, if you clean your room, you get a gold coin worth 3 truckloads of candy. And then,
Oh, hyperbole!
I don't know, it was a pretty big drawer Rebecca opened. And then it becomes a look and find game. And the structure of it is a big, meaning a parent, grandparent, older sibling, reads with a little, meaning kindergarten, first, second, third grader, to find all the crazy stuff in her room, her collection of chewed up bubble gum, her lightning fried lizards, and slowly work down through the process of cleaning up her room. And once we finished it and created this thing that was fun and interactive in a game, that's when I learned about the initiatives of the United Way of the Black Hills and Black Hills Reads and the South Dakota Statewide Family Engagement Center, that they were focusing on early childhood reading initiatives. Because, as you know, and I didn't know, 32% of elementary school kids in the United States are reading at grade level proficiency. 32%, that's a crazy number. And I didn't know that you can correlate within 2 jumps on a checkerboard third grade reading ability with prison capacity planning. That's crazy. And so I learned that apart from developing early childhood reading skills, the other thing they were really working to do is to create family engagement. And I realized Porter did that, so we teamed up with United Way of the Black Hills, Black Hills Reads, South Dakota Statewide Family Engagement Center, and created this reading program, which is rolling out now.
All right. Lots of things to unpack there. Let's go back to the pigeon, right? Because the great Mo Willems in his illustrations always says he wants to illustrate something that you can draw. I never draw anything that the kids can't draw.
Right.
And Porter is like that in the sense that she starts with some simple shapes. So not only is it a book for reading, but it's really an art book inviting kids into that art space as well. Because and then when you look at the front pages, all these different costumes and different ways, you know, almost like a paper doll, but yet, you know, these hilarious and quirky manifestations of Porter's personalities, mm-hmm. I can make my own.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit, Rebecca, about really telling kids through the way that you create art that they can create art too.
It's been really exciting because as we read to the children, then we kind of break away and I'll have a whiteboard and a marker and I'll be able to show them step by step how to draw Porter because, you know, we encourage them that they can write and they can draw so they could do what we're doing too. And they say, well, I can't draw. And it is really easy when you break it down step by step. And one thing that we really get to talk about a lot is she has a lot of emotions. Yeah. And there are three things on the face that you can change to create any emotion.
We should ask the audience, what do you think? Three things.
Three things, what do you think?
What can you change as an illustrator to create emotion? I mean, those eyebrows. All right.
Yeah, you have the mouth, and then you have two eyebrows.
Yeah.
And so whether the eyebrows are slanted up or down, whether she's smiling or frowning or her mouth is round, you can create hundreds of expressions and teach kids about these emotions and reactions.
One of my favorite children's stories of all time, I don't know if you remember it or have come across it, it's Mrs. Pigglewiggle. So Mrs. Pigglewiggle was like all about natural consequences before that was a thing. And so I grew up with her, and like there was this story, and I can't remember the boy's name, but he didn't clean his room. And so it was, well, then don't clean. You know, his parents were at their wits' ends, and you know, he goes, and pretty soon they're like feeding him a sandwich on a rake from outside the window. And then that Mrs. Pigglewiggle's got her kind of, you know, her magic. Mm-hmm. A messy room is, and again, it's that hyperbole. It's mm-hmm. It is so messy. It's not just that you didn't pick up your laundry. It's that you, and I was one of those kids who was completely overwhelmed by having to clean my room, like into tears.
Me too.
And my mother would come in and she'd say, you have 20 minutes, and everything that's not picked up, I'm going to take away when you're done. So for 20 minutes, I'd cry. I'd be like, do I love this doll? Or do I love this teddy bear? Well, I could have been done by the time I was obsessing. And so there's something happening here with what is garbage? Mm-hmm. What has value to mm-hmm. you? Mm-hmm. And it's okay to keep the things that you that have value.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And one thing that we ran into as we were developing Porter was we worked with a child psychologist to focus on positive and negative messaging.
Yeah.
Because clean your room is inherently accusational, and you're dirty, and also it's a command. Whereas Porter's question is always, should she do this? Not can she? And it creates a third party to have a dialogue about what you want to keep and what you should clean up and yada, yada. I mean, Porter the Hoarder is a series of 64 books, and the first four are now created, published, and available. So the next book, she's on a nature hike, and can she keep the fossilized deer dookie and the flatulent flying fish? Or then she's making a pizza, and the last time she did it, it was 200 feet tall and had tires and bullfrogs on it.
Right.
So you create a whole world of weird stuff and begin a lot of different conversations.
Silly, it's weird, it's wonderful. And you mentioned, Sean, this notion of parents kind of... One of the things that I always found when I was really, you know, trying to get, you know, people to love children's books is that parents don't, I mean, I love it. I could read anything. You can give me a wordless picture book and I can sit down and spend, you know, 30 minutes with my kid, and it's the best thing. Mm-hmm. Other parents are like, oh my gosh, there are no words in this book. What do I do? They're freaked out by it.
Yeah.
This tells you exactly how to read the book. This, I mean, this is it's, you can't get it wrong,
right?
Because it's question, it's response.
It is. And everything that we set out to do was about interaction. We wanted a book that was a game and a game that happened to be a book. And when we started to develop the reading program, we learned about the four issues that get in the way of reading at home that are consistent regardless of socioeconomic status. And the biggest one's time.
Right.
You know? And the question that parents have is, how long is it going to take to read this book? And with Porter, it reads in under 10 minutes, usually about 7, and they can see that. So it fits in the crack. Second is a book that kids are excited to read, and that's a lot about marketing from the outside world. We flip that. We get them excited in the classroom when we do our Porter launch projects. And then parents knowing how to read to a child, if they weren't read to as a kid often, they don't really know how to pass that skill on. So the way we do our classroom rollouts, we teach the kids how to teach their parents. We assign parent homework, and structure of the book shows parents how to read together, but in this way, we fill the kids up with the knowledge and send them home, and finally cost. Books are expensive, and I didn't realize that schools buy books for about 20% off retail, usually. So we manufacture our own, and we're able to work with our partners to be able to give these books, the Ransack Room books, to first graders across South Dakota for free. So
tell me about some of those launches, those school visits, what do you bring into the classroom?
Chaos. Chaos. We leave with
on
chaos.
Purpose.
Yes. We bring in curiosity, we leave chaos. And it's fun. We come in and they introduce us saying there's an illustrator and an author who are here today. We show the physical copy of the book. Then we project the pages up on a smart board or a large screen. Students get up to help find all the stuff while I read Porter's reaction, her voices, and Rebecca reads all the narration. And then at the end, I mean, one thing that we say is, you know, you get them in a group and they're sitting in front of the board and we say, okay, you know, it's important to mind your manners and raise your hand. And this has been conditioned into this group of first graders. And so they kind of nod. And I say, we're not doing that today. It's a different deal. So when you see something, freak out and scream about where it is. Once we've got them super excited and we've gone through the book, we ask, you know, would you like your own Porter book? And fortunately, so far, they've said yes. That's good.
I was like, I'm good.
We've had enough. And then we say, well, you know, thanks to your school and thanks to your teachers, you get a book and you get a book and everybody gets their own books and they're going crazy. And then we throw the wet blanket and I said, but listen, there's homework. And they just, oh. We say, it's not for you, it's for your parents. And we have the parent homework document. You have to teach your parents. And they're just going nuts. And then Rebecca shows them piece by piece how to draw Porter and start telling their own stories.
And tell us about the parent homework.
Parent homework. There's a document that goes out.
Here it is.
This goes out with the books.
Our visual aid for the radio.
We'll be giving away 10,000 copies of the book this year, so hopefully lots of parents are seeing this document. But it's a great, big, huge 8.5 by 17 document that cannot be avoided. And it's called the Parents Porter Explanation Thing. It's like comic book strip. It says, this is what Porter is, and this is how you read together, and you read together. And in the lower right corner is the cell phone, the distraction-free zone where you put your cell phone.
Put your cell phone down.
Put your cell phone down. Put it here. And, you know, that's what one of the things we love about Porter. It's easy to give a child a book and say, go read this. And oftentimes in schools, that's what happens. They have a journal of time that they've read. But that can just as easily be an iPad. And it's a project on their own. This requires a big to sit down with a little, you know? So put the distraction away, put the technology away, and let's get to this. It just so happens to be reading.
This week, we celebrate the Young Readers Festival at the South Dakota Festival of Books. Let's keep the author interviews coming. Here's Tracy Sorrell and Tracy Nelson Maurer.
I think everybody who listens to this show knows how much I love children's books and how much I get fangirl with children's authors. And there's two really great ones sitting in front of me today. We have Tracy Nelson Maurer and Tracy Sorrell. So Tracy is down here at the end of the table if you're in our live studio audience, and other Tracy is right here next to me.
We are the Tracys.
The Tracys are here. And we've got very different books, but all award-winning, starred reviews in the publications like Kirkus and Hornbook and School Library Journal, the places that really understand children's literature. So we are at the top echelon of children's books with both Tracys here. So we're going to spend some time getting to know them a little bit. And Tracy Sorrell, let's start with you, because your books have made a splash because of how beautiful and eloquently written they are, but also because they come from this place of your own Cherokee heritage. Tell us a little bit about some of your early experiences with children's literature, because you probably weren't reading stories with Cherokee people in them when you were growing up.
No, in fact, the only book that I remember reading as a child was actually read to us. In my third grade class, I had a Cherokee teacher. She's a Cherokee citizen like I am. And she read Where the Red Fern Grows, which is by Cherokee author Wilson Rawls. But it's not centered in like necessarily Cherokee culture, but it's certainly in northeastern Oklahoma where I grew up. Outside of that, all the other books I read were by non-native people and really otherized us. You know, there was not us being depicted in our humanity, and it really didn't matter what tribe, you know, that I was reading about. So as a child, I never saw Native people as having any agency or any real identity or their full humanity on the page, and I didn't really connect with it. So when someone asked me one time, you know, so did you see, you know, Native people? I said, no, because when I read that, I was like, that's not like my family or my community. I don't relate to any of that, you know. It just was a divorce from my experience, you know, but I loved reading. And so I was always in my school library and in my public library. I went to a Title I school. We had RIF Day, Reading is Fundamental. I loved getting to pick out a book every year and take home. So even though I didn't see myself or the community that I lived in, I still had a love of reading.
So when you open the box, which book comes first, At the Mountain's Base or We Are Grateful?
We Are Grateful, Ojale Haliga is the first book that came out last fall.
When you open the box for this book and you see it for the first time, with contemporary Cherokee people doing things like taking their kids for a walk mm-hmm. and you know, having a meal and talking about serving your country and all these just these real normal everyday things. Mm-hmm. What is that box moment like for you?
Actually, I recorded video of it and put it on Twitter because I'd seen other authors do that, and it produced real tears because the reason that I started writing was because I had read all of our traditional stories, and my son had heard Cherokee people telling our stories. We'd read traditional stories from other tribes, but I was like, okay, where's the contemporary Cherokee story in a picture book that I can share with him? And when I realized there wasn't one, and there wasn't any depiction that I could share with him, which I couldn't believe, because he's just not quite 10 years old, that's when I figured out I had to write it. So opening the box and knowing that this book would be available to any Cherokee family, to any other Native family, teachers, educators, it just was this moment of elation and pride and all kind of all this range of feelings, which I still feel now. And so I work really hard to make sure that what is largely invisible, which is our presence contemporarily in the United States, becomes more visible. And so I'm actively recruiting other, people from other Native nations who write, who do art, to enter into this business, because our children deserve to see themselves in the books that they're growing up. And the majority of Native kids go to public schools. And the public school curriculum and the teachers who are largely in that environment don't have the resources within their texts and the knowledge themselves. And so these are wonderful resources for them to have in the classrooms. And same for librarians who are doing public programming.
So many people who want to write children's books will say, I can't find any books about this. And then I can say, well, I can name five. And, mm-hmm. here they are, because they maybe haven't read deeply mm-hmm. in children's literature and they don't love it yet. They're just excited. They have a story they want to tell, which is a great way to begin. Mm-hmm. But in your case, there's a real gap here.
Right.
And you step into it so beautifully mm-hmm. and with English and with the traditional language. Mm-hmm. Now, do you speak the language? Did you have to find someone to help put the Cherokee words here in the book as well?
I've taken classes while I was in college, and I'm currently in a class now where I'm also learning the language. Cherokee is, on the scale of languages, one of the most difficult, in the world to learn. It's a polysyllabic language, polysyncretic language. It's a very, very difficult language. But so I don't ever know that I will be at a fluency level. I'm very much at an elementary level. So I did, for most of the words that I use in here, I did know those or find those myself. But I did work with the Cherokee Nation's language program to make sure that I had the usage correct for the context and the syllabary.
Yeah. And then definitions in the back, the syllabary, an author's note. Mm-hmm. So it's a book that you can read as a picture book before bedtime, as mm-hmm. for the joy of it. And then it's also, as you kind of alluded to, teachers and parents, and if your curriculum is the Trail of Tears and that's all you've got, mm-hmm. it might be time to branch out a little bit.
Yes.
And
yes, and that really is what prompted the book, because after traditional stories, then you hear about Cherokee people in relation to the Trail of Tears. Okay, well, the Trail of Tears ends in 1839, right? We've reformed a constitution, we've established ourselves in Indian country, and then we disappear. Like, there is absolutely nothing about us after that. So from 1900 on, you wouldn't know we would go through allotment, We have Oklahoma statehood, and then there's this very anti, Native environment within the state of Oklahoma. But yet we're still here, and we're a very strong nation. And, our new chief, who was just elected this summer, has quadrupled our language program. So it's the largest investment, because he goes, what does it matter if we have all these programs if we don't make sure that our children and our children's children can speak the language? That really is at the heart of this, is what is important. And it's important that kids see themselves, that they're, foundational in their cultural knowledge, but it's also important for their peers and other adults around them to know that we're still here. And we are vital contributors to the larger fabric of society.
And you're part of that. You're part of that.
Yeah, it's the best job in the world. I mean, I've done a lot of different things, but this is definitely the best job in the world. There's no question.
I want to talk about At the Mountain's Base. And I begin with what I always tell people, how to read a children's picture book. And that's the first thing you do is, unless it's a library book and it's been fastened on, is you take off the cover and you look at the entire book. And when you take off the cover of At the Mountain's Base, there is this beautiful pattern underneath it. It's not the same thing as the illustration on the cover. Tell us, before we get into the book itself and what it's about this gorgeous art on the cover, which you're not the illustrator, but it's
right.
Has a lot of meaning.
Well, yes, normally, you'll see the dust jacket and the case cover are the same. And in this case, the publisher offered the illustrator the option to create a different if she had that in mind. And she says, actually, I do have an idea for a design. And so in the book, Cherokee finger weaving is showcased. And when you lift the, for those in the studio office, I'll demonstrate. So when you lift the dust jacket off, you see this Cherokee finger weaving underneath. And the end papers, when you open the book up, you'll see the pieces of yarn that are used for finger weaving. And the illustrations inside, each panel is lined with yarn for the illustrations. It's just stunning. I have no visual artistic abilities, all props to Washoyo Alvitre. And Jasmine, she's the illustrator, Washoyo is, and then Jasmine Ribeiro, who's the art director for Kokula Books at Penguin, just designed a phenomenal book, and I'm the beneficiary of
and
that.
And I haven't met the illustrator, I haven't asked any questions, but as I read the text, there is that thread that goes through everything. Mm-hmm. It's very poetic.
Yes.
And it is really about Native women serving their country, which also kind of gives me some chills.
Yeah.
Why this topic? Why was this important?
Sometimes ideas come to me just from something I've observed. This book, actually, I read another children's book called In the Village by the Sea about a family in Southeast Asia waiting for their dad to come home from fishing. And I loved the structure of it. I was like, that is such a tight poem. Where it starts is where it ends. It's a circular poem. I want to write a book in that vein. And so I thought, but I had a very different idea. And as I'm writing this, it comes to me that the pilot needs to be a woman, because although people know about Natives serving in the U.S. Armed Forces, notably the Code Talkers, the Choctaws in World War I that weren't allowed to kind of be publicized till more recently. And then in World War II, we know about Navajo and men from a number of different tribes serving as Code Talkers. But we really don't have any mention of women. And yet women have served in intertribal conflicts prior to Europeans ever setting face, on this continent. Certainly once Europeans are here and they're vying for their own territories, women are serving in those conflicts, as well as, now after the formation of the United States. And so I wanted to shine a light on that, but then also to the families that are that support network. I mean, in, communities of Native nations, I don't care if it's a Cherokee Nation, I don't care if it's a Ogallala, Lakota Nation, it doesn't matter. They're all veterans, and those who are actively serving are esteemed. We hold them in extremely high regard. And given the treatment that we have been dealt with as Native nations and citizens within the larger United States, it's amazing that there is still that selfless, act of service that goes on. But it happens. So this, again, is, while it's a poem and it's fictional about this family, it talks about that. And in the back end of it, and this is where sometimes that's why it's a team that makes a book. Washoyo has come up with gorgeous illustrations for this. The publisher, Namrata Chapati, who heads up Kokula Books, and she's a vice president there at Penguin, she says, now there's an Oglala Lakota woman who was one of the women Air Force service pilots in World War II, don't you? And I said, no, I don't, but that's wonderful, and we're going to put that in the author's notes. So there's a whole paragraph about Ola Mildred Rexroth, who went by Millie, and her service and how she continued to serve after World War II. She was the only Native American among the women Air Force service pilots, but she continued to serve through the Korean War. And, I can't think of a more dangerous position than working and towing targets behind my plane for these male students who are not professionals, right, and are getting their training to shoot at, right? I mean, that just sounds horrific to me, like worse than being in battle with people, you know, are trained to do this stuff. But then she continues on, and she's an air traffic controller, and she's hauling personnel and cargo throughout the war. So again, it's that shining a light on what's invisible and making it visible so that people understand we make contributions in a number of areas. Just because you may not have heard about that, you know, you now know.
Up next, from inside the SDPB Rapid City studio, it's Jesse Taken Alive Rencounter.
Jesse Taken Alive Rencounter is with us in the studio. Jesse, thank you for being here.
Of course, thank you for inviting me.
So the great story about Jesse's book is I cannot get a copy of it, no matter how many times. Like, it's so popular that it's like I've been here and we just sold out. I've been here and I could order it. But I keep waiting to come across it, and I just never do. It's been something that's so well received. Tell me a little bit, give us the title of the book, and tell us a little bit about why you wrote it, and then we'll talk about that response that people have had.
Yeah. Of course. So the title of the book is called Peta Shows Misu the Light. And, you know, I served as a school counselor now, probably my 13th year now as a school counselor. And some of those years I've spent in the high school, and most of the years I've spent with elementary students. And hearing students come in and share some of their really sad stories and their difficult situations that we're in, I utilize a lot of my teachings from my culture, from my parents that were taught values and such spirituality things that were taught to me through my Lakota culture, and was given a dream. And after I had said some prayers for guidance and working with these young people, I received a dream and a message that I was to share with the children. And so I turned it into a children's book to reach more children. So
we spoke earlier in the hour, and I said that a lot of people who want to become children's authors will say, this book hasn't been written yet, and sometimes I'll be like, well, there's five of them, you know, here they are. Mm-hmm. In your case, there just isn't a lot of Lakota children's literature, any kind of Indigenous people's literature, Native American literature. It's really limited. There's some great stuff out there, but it's not something that you're going to just stumble upon in the bookstore or library usually.
Right, right. And I think, you know, what it comes down to is we've had a lot of, I think Dawn had touched on this, there's a lot of stories in our culture that have been passed down for many generations, but have not really maybe been put into stories or children's books. And we come right now from a society that our way of life is so different from our ancestors, where storytelling was a huge thing that was going on, and that's how we taught our values. And now it's like our fast-paced way of life in our society today is really different, and so it's really hard to sit down and share these stories. And so thus, you know, a lot of these stories have not necessarily been put into books, and it's difficult for, you know, our children to have access to these stories. So
tell me about hearing stories growing up.
Oh yes, my mother Cheryl is one of the best oral storytellers ever. And I would love when she would tell her stories. And she did a lot of work with groups back home on a reservation in Standing Rock, where she would make up stories that would incorporate a lot of the values. And then I think maybe that's where I got that from with this book. But it's growing up, I would love listening to my mother's stories because it just kind of took you into a different place. And so not everyone gets that opportunity to have storytellers like how I did with my mother. Mm-hmm. And so me wanting to share this message that, you know, was given to me in a dream and what I would share with students in my office for a few years, I thought, you know what, I need to make this into a book and realize that I could reach more children and people in general with writing a book. So yeah.
Do you tell them stories?
I do.
I
like to, and that's what I found that how I can connect to the students is when I can share some stories with them that usually have some type of lesson or value incorporated into it.
You said some of the stories they were telling you, some of their experiences were hard to hear.
Yes.
And I think, you know, we're celebrating these books and we're, you know, celebrating the one book, you know, being a Lakota story, a collection, or, you know, three different Lakota books in one by Don Montalope. But I don't want to brush over the fact that what you're hearing, the lived experience of these children, is not always a positive thing. Tell me about some of the things that kids are facing in school, in life, in culture.
Yes, of course. So we have little children. It doesn't matter what cultural background you come from, or income, you know, in a house. And so we have children that experience some bullying in school. Bullying, or sometimes children come to school really sad because, you know, family is splitting, or there's divorce in the home, or maybe there's some addiction that is, you know, happening with a loved one or a family member. And sometimes these children don't know how to incorporate that into thinking that, hey, this is not my fault. You know, a lot of them think that it's their fault. What can I do to make it better? Mm-hmm. You know, or what did I do? Why is this happening? And so I have a lot of those questions over the years, and, you know, why is this happening, Mrs. Rencounter? And sometimes those stories are so heartbreaking that as a professional, I really have to fight back my own tears.
Right.
And, you know, put my professional face on, my professional voice on. And so there's only so much that you've been trained as a school counselor when you go to graduate school to help with. And of course, I use all those, you know, teachings and stuff in graduate school. And that's why I turned to prayer, you know, earlier, a few years back, and said, I need some help with these children.
Yeah.
So.
You can't fix it.
You can't.
I mean, there's some things you can, I mean, maybe there's, you know, if there's a bullying situation, it's not like you can sit back and say, there's nothing I can do. I don't mean to imply that. There's things that you do that are actively engaging. But the pain itself, sometimes just being present,
right,
is a challenge enough as it is.
Yes. And so, you know, I want to kind of, my hope in this book is try to inspire our children, to let them realize that, hey, you know what? Hurting people hurt other people. But also to have that sense of compassion. But also, more importantly, to have a sense of hope in knowing that there is something that they can do to make our world become a better place. And so that's what my book tries to incorporate that message into.
Yeah.
So,
are you must be delighted with the response. How many people, tell me how people have responded.
Well, I am really overwhelmed with the love that the book has been getting, you know. And my husband and I, we do some presentations, cultural presentations, sometimes at Crazy Horse, sometimes for, you know, tour groups in town. And, you know, we have people that come and, you know, I share at the end of our presentations, after our song and dance presentations, that I wrote a children's book, you know, and I really briefly just describe what it's about, that it's, you know, teaches compassion, forgiveness, kindness, and, you know, what we can do to make our world become a better place. And, you know, some of the people will buy it right there. And about, I mean, 45 minutes later, an hour later, they'll come back to me and say, this is not just for children. This is for everyone, all ages. And I've had people come up to me, adults, crying and saying, it's a beautiful message that we all need to be reminded about. And so I always like to say that I can't take full credit for this, that I was just available to be there to receive that message so I can share it.
Nick Estes is a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, and he joined Lori Walsh for this year's Festival of Books.
Me at the table, our first guest, who is Nick Estes, and his book that we're talking about today is called Our History is the Future. He is a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe and an assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico. Nick, thanks for being here. Thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also has a presentation later on today for people where you just get to talk and not be asked questions. But so I encourage you to check that out as well. I want to start in the beginning of this book, because one of the things about the book festival, with, you know, the ideas and the authors and the, you know, the connections that people make, are also sometimes just a scene in the book that will stay with a reader forever. And in the beginning of your book, there is one of those scenes. And maybe I can name 5 to 20 of those scenes in literature and in nonfiction and fiction books that I've read. This one I'll never forget. And I want you to walk people through it a little bit, because you were at a mall on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, in Bismarck, North Dakota, and water protectors are going into the mall and they are identified for the police by the smell of campfire, because they smell like they've been somewhere else other than this mall. And it's such a contrast between a mall on Black Friday and where they have come from. Take me there a little bit and tell me what you and Water Protectors are trying to do on that day, and then how you were received.
Sure. So Hamantakiapi, for those who are listening, good morning. I just want to also acknowledge that we're in Deadwood right now, and this is Lakota territory. This is our holiest of holy sites, where they have built casinos and an entire gaming and entertainment industry, not for Native people. So I just want to point that out, because there is a contradiction and a tension there that I try to point to in this particular scene that you're referencing. And that particular moment, it was, we had driven all the way from, I was living in California, Southern California at the time, and I had driven up with a human rights immigration lawyer who's indigenous from Southern California, and an environmental activist and writer who also has a book out, Deena Hilia Whitaker, called As Long as the Grass Grows. And we were, we were driving to this encampment through Wyoming, and we ended up arriving around, I think it was the night of Thanksgiving, or the next day we arrived at Black Friday, and had actually met up with some people who I had known in the camp, some relatives, but also some people who I had grown up with in, the white-dominated town of Chamberlain, South Dakota. So it wasn't just a Native movement. There were a lot of non-Native people who were there. And so that was really fascinating to me. And he and his wife, or his partner, joined us at this mall protest. And we, I think one of the things that's really important to highlight is that fire itself is very central to Lakota storytelling and ceremonial life. And there's only been one other time in my life after returning from a ceremony, coming into Rapid City, where somebody in Walmart, an employee, had pointed out that the group of people that I was walking with, my relatives, my family, had they smelled like campfire, but they also smelled like an Indian. And so this was the context. So it wasn't something that was unique to that particular situation. But as we entered, the crowd, the first thing, we were there for maybe about, 5 minutes before the police actually started violently grabbing, they attacked this group of women right off the bat. And they were armed head to toe. They had AR-15s slung on their shoulders. So it was a very tense situation. And they weren't just going after Native people. They were going after people who looked like Natives, but anyone who smelled like campfire. So there was a white guy who smelled like a campfire. He had a beard. I don't know if he was from Bismarck or if he was with us, but he was arrested as well. And I think the
on
reason
what
why
charge
on what I don't actually
because the
know.
Women
I think
in
it was
the book are arrested like going into the bathroom in a public mall, and that's her protest. I'm on the way to the bathroom. But
I think the Bismarck Tribune actually reported it as trespassing, because the Bismarck mall isn't a public space; it's a private space for business. So I think that's the charges that they were brought up on. But so this was happening, and there were white people from the crowd who were coming out and just yelling obscenities and slurs, as I pointed out in the book. And it was a very tense situation, but at the same time, it wasn't there were Native and non-Native water protectors, and it wasn't a hard action. We weren't trying to disrupt the construction of a pipeline. We weren't at a pipeline construction site. We were just trying to raise awareness about that this was still going on. And it's important to point out that Bismarck is 90% white capital of the state of North Dakota, and originally the pipeline had been scheduled to or routed to cross above Bismarck, and it was rerouted, citing the crossage of certain waterways, but also it was just more convenient to reroute it upriver of an 80% Native American community. And in those reports that the Army Corps of Engineers had filed, it wasn't the Dakota Access Pipeline Company. It was actually the Army Corps of Engineers filed these reports saying, we need to make it look like it's not disproportionately affecting a racial minority. Those were their words, they're not mine. So that it was clearly, you know, a form of environmental racism, but at the same time, there was a form of NIMBYism that the white community wanted this pipeline, but not in their backyard. So it was kind of a confluence of, you know, history. It happened the day after Thanksgiving, this, you know, mythical made-up holiday that the United States likes to celebrate. And next to, you know, on the day of a consumer holiday, where the majority of retail stores actually make their profits from, on a day that we don't really think about the history of this nation, and especially in a place like oil and gas country like North Dakota, we don't think about indigenous people. And so that was the context of that particular scene.
As this book is structured, and you mentioned history, there's seven chapters, and it's a history of indigenous resistance, how these things are connected, some of the same themes that come up again and again. For folks who haven't read the book, might be thinking about going over and picking it up today, give us an idea of what some of those chapters are, so just to touch on a little bit so people know what they'll be able to read about.
Sure, please. So I've been writing and doing this history for over 10 years, and it started specifically on doing history about the dams, the Pixelon Dams, the five earthen roll dams specifically that flooded Lakota and Dakota reservations in South Dakota and in North Dakota. So I really begin with that history. In my family's history, I have two grandfathers who were tribal historians, and that's where I became really introduced to this particular history. But I begin in the present, and then I go to the past immediately in the first chapter, or the second chapter, I go to origins, looking at the entry of capitalism into this region with the fur trade, which itself was an extractive industry. The first man camps were actually fur trade forts, and then later became the kind of white-dominated border towns that ring Indian reservations today, creating a certain kind of political dynamic and economic dynamic. And then the third chapter is called War, where they detail the counterinsurgency tactics that were employed by the United States government, both in the terms of military and Indian policy, to subdue the Lakota, Dakota people. The fourth chapter looks at the floods that were created by the dam and the destruction of our river bottomlands, the destruction of 75% of our wildlife, the destruction of 90% of our commercial timber, and the removal of over 1,000 native families to essentially pull this region out of the Great Recession and to provide post-war employment and irrigation and flood control. And if anybody's been watching the news today, none of those things have come to pass, right? Irrigation, only 5% of the promised irrigation has been implemented by the dams, and obviously we're still suffering from floods. And then the fifth chapter is Red Power, where I kind of ground the history of Red Power within a specific tribal national context, within the Lakota and Dakota experience. Specifically those families who were physically removed from their homelands because of the flooding, but then also because of a program called Relocation and Termination, where they tried to liquidate tribal governments, and they found themselves kind of in these far-off urban centers, but then didn't stop being Indian, didn't stop being indigenous, and found themselves and created what we now know as the Red Power Movement, which began in the early 1960s and kind of coalesced around the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969, which we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of that, leading to the Wounded Knee occupation in 1973. And then the sixth chapter is internationalism and thinking about, you know, this movement as an international movement and not something that was parochial and kind of grounded in quote-unquote something that could just be seen as local cultures. And how the touchstone document that we have, the 2007 UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, actually began in Standing Rock, and it began in this particular part of the country. In 1974, they had a historic treaty council meeting, International Indian Treaty Council, where the traditional chiefs allied with the tribal councils decided that they were gonna take the treaty claim, the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, to the United Nations, because they tried it in the federal government, and the federal government, you know, basically, or the federal courts, and the federal courts basically said, well, if, you know, we acknowledge that this is an international relationship, so why is a federal court, you know, trying to decide on this particular decision? And that was the groundwork that was needed, or the justification that was needed to take this to the world court. And that's a story that hasn't really been told. I think it's a story here in this particular region that US media turned its back on the Red Power movement at that time. They were no longer reporting on it, partially because you know, a lot of these Treaty Council people began seeing themselves as part of this kind of global decolonization movement and not just seeking a rights-based discourse or rights-based framework within the context of the United States. And so then the last chapter is called Liberation, where I return back to the camps and look at how the camps themselves kind of embody a specific cultural, political, and social alternative to the status quo right now, meaning that there's a kind of an accusation that's leveled at indigenous people that if we do get our land back, we're going to do what to white settlers what they did to us, which is completely cynical. You know, they're going to genocide you, we're going to remove you from your land, and we're going to take all your natural resources and confine you to, you know, little plots of unusable land, which is completely absurd. And that's, you know, this is being propagated in the media right now as the great replacement narrative by white supremacists such as Trump and his followers. And we can see the limits of that, right? Because if we look at the camps, everyone was welcome. Well, just about everybody was welcome into those camps, even non-Indigenous people. And so I talk about how, you know, people I went to high school with, white kids I went to high school with, found themselves there because they were so disillusioned by the 2016 elections.
Because when you enter the camp, you're given, you're told, here's where you can go for your health care,
right.
Here's where you can go for your food. And when you first entered the, I think people need to understand that a little bit more, what you're saying,
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
Is that there was a sense that at some point there's education that's
right.
being provided, that in this community around the camps, which was often hard to see as things that were posted on Facebook were really largely about, you know, conflicts between law enforcement and private security
right.
officers, and people fixated on certain things. But really what was happening in the camps,
exactly.
as you say, was this community that really embraced each other, embraced the other,
yeah.
and provided services that were needed.
And it wasn't perfect, and I don't want to romanticize it, but it was organized based on need, right? What people need, free food, free healthcare, you know, to an extent. There was educational services, there was a strong sense of community where everyone was welcome. And most, you know, Native reservations don't have those services, first of all, but most communities in the United States don't have those services. And so I think that was kind of the optimism that those camps provided.
You talk about the strength of being relational
mm-hmm.
in the sense that, you know, inviting non-Native people in, inviting Indigenous people who aren't necessarily connected to their culture in, as a way forward for everyone. And contrast that against capitalism. Talk a little bit about what that means relationally. And when people think about capitalism in a negative way, other people say, well, you want to collapse the economy, you don't want, like, mm-hmm. what does that mean? They get afraid. What does that look like to you?
So right now, as we're speaking, the Amazon rainforest is on fire. And why? Why is it on fire? It's not on fire because there's been some misguided policies in Brazil. It's on fire because, you know, large land lords have collaborated with the state to essentially burn large portions of it, to privatize it, to create areas for farming and ranching, right? To destroy, you know, the largest carbon sink in the world. So this is the death drive of capitalism. It doesn't make sense to destroy the very oxygen that you need to breathe on this planet. So what the water protectors were doing was protecting water that everybody needs, even the people who don't agree with us politically or socially or whatever. We're protecting that water for them as well. And that's, you know, we can get into the esoteric kind of beliefs of indigenous people and how they do have this relationship to the non-human world, but that's not important for non-native people to understand. What is important for non-native people to understand is that access to clean drinking water should be a fundamental human right, and that's something that we all can organize around and demand as a fundamental human right. And so when we're talking about relationality, I don't think a society that has built on the premise of stolen land, right? A drive it like you stole it mentality is an ethical society. And so if it's not an ethical society, then we need to begin imagining new ways of relating to each other that aren't premised on coercion and theft.
You started our conversation by pointing out that the place that we're in right now as a casino, we're broadcasting from the Deadwood Mountain Grand in the community of Deadwood, and you talked about its history. And then people say, okay, I can acknowledge that. And you said, well, you can acknowledge it, but you keep doing it. It's like acknowledging a crime is being committed, but you don't do anything to stop it. All right, so what next? What do you tell people? How do you take that next step? If someone says, you know, yeah, okay, Nick, I'm with you. It's what,
like,
do I do now?
Yeah, I'm, it's sure, like somebody like rolls up in your car that they just stole, and they'd be like, hey, I just stole your car, and then they drive off. Like, what does it actually do? And I think right now the Keystone XL pipeline is coming through here, and I think a lot of people in the state, non-Native people, I think that there's a big difference between what counts as the state government and the people who live in this state, right? Okay. There's a big difference. The people who are in power don't necessarily represent all the time the people who actually have to live on the land, where they're doing everything they can to make sure that this happens. I mean, we just heard on this news brief that they're trying to get water for this. I think in this particular moment in time, that we have to go beyond just like the two-party system that's available to us, because we have to understand that the Dakota Access Pipeline happened under the Obama administration, which kicked off the largest oil and gas drilling, increased oil and gas drilling by 88% within his administration, and they targeted specifically indigenous lands, right? Trump has only amplified that project that began under Obama. So while it is important to have certain people elected to power, the real power, I think, comes from the bottom up, and the relations that we make with each other between Native and non-Native people. And to go back to this specific place, the Homestake Mine once had an organization called Miners for Clean Energy that adopted as its union principle the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty in 1980, saying that safe working conditions were premised on upholding Native sovereignty. And I thought that was a really and I actually met one of those guys. He now works for the National Nurses Union, which is one of the most powerful unions in this country. But I thought that was a really promising kind of step. And those are the kind of histories that we should be building on and reflecting on, that even people who were engaged in the extractive industry understood the contradiction of what it meant to be, you know, somebody who was working in this gold mine and actively participating in the dispossession of indigenous peoples, but could understand that actually allying with indigenous peoples benefited their safety as workers themselves, and to transition into a carbon-free, or at that time they were using the word sustainable energy programs. And that was in 1980 around the Black Hills Alliance. They successfully defeated efforts to begin uranium and coal mining in the Black Hills. And so it's not that we try to repeat the past, but those are foundations that we can build on.
There is, in our remaining minutes, a picture and a story about, as you mentioned, President Obama and the crash. I think everybody remembers the economic crash of 2008. And really, the conversation around oil is age old, but it's also fairly new, because America's oil production has changed since that time. And there's a picture of, I'm going to forget her name until I find it, but she's in the penny dress. And you just tell me, if you can, a little bit about opening the ears of people and how it's represented in Rochelle Bullhead's penny dress. In this picture, it's Rochelle Bullhead. Yeah.
So, I mean, history is very much alive in that particular scene, in the sense that she's talking about how somebody such as the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln, had signed the death sentences of 38 Dakota patriots the same week that he signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And this is an uncomfortable history to live with, in that there was this war of extermination, what it was called the Columns of Vengeance, to destroy the people who later became the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, the Dakota who were fleeing the U.S. Dakota War. And so in that particular moment, they drilled holes pennies into the ears of Lincoln, because he wouldn't listen in this life, so he'd listen better in the afterlife. And I think in this particular moment, as we in the lead up to the 2020 elections, we're facing another. You know, this was in 2016 with a 2016 election. There was a major pipeline going through our lands. 2020, there's another major pipeline going through our lands, And it's not to say that history repeats itself, but it echoes. And sometimes it echoes in tragedy, and sometimes it echoes in victory. And so we have to be on the side of the victorious on this one.
Nick Estes is the author of Our History is the Future. Thank you for the time that you spent with us today. You'll be at the book signing. You have a talk later on this afternoon. Encourage people to check it out. Thanks.
All right, thanks.
Megan Phelps Roper is a writer and an activist. She took time out of her day to join Lori Walsh in Deadwood for this year's South Dakota Festival of Books.
We have a wonderful audience here, standing room only, in our little corner of the world. And sitting with me at the table, Megan Phelps Roper has a new book coming out called Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. Maybe that's all we have to say to introduce that book. It released on Tuesday.
Right.
All right. Welcome. Tuesday coming. So thank you for being here with us. This is one of your first radio interviews about this book, but it will not be the last. You have a lot planned coming up.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the response to the release of this book and some of the anticipation that you're feeling as an author.
Wow. The response so far has been really positive. I think people have an image of Westboro, which is largely, almost entirely my family, my extended family. It was started by my grandfather. I think people have this image of them as these crazed doomsayers and as sort of monstrous people who are, you know, deliberately doing things that they know are wrong. And I think my book shows other sides of them that are largely hidden from outsiders.
This is a book largely about empathy, in the sense that your own journey toward learning empathy for the people that you're speaking out with hatred toward. And also from people who don't know this family, seeing them as, you know, parent mothers, fathers, people who read stories to you, people who kiss you when you fall down. I know I was partway into it, and I had to flip back to the cover, and I was like, oh, loving and leaving. and I paused for a minute because I was wondering if that empathy is misplaced and if people have said to you, is that the best place for your empathy to fall at this time?
Yes. So, yes, people have absolutely made that argument that, you know, that maybe we should be focusing exclusively on the victims and targets of groups like Westboro. And I completely understand that, and I absolutely do believe that those people deserve our empathy and attention and anything that we can do to help those groups. The part about, you know, I was changed by people who had empathy for me, even though, you know, you could absolutely argue that I didn't deserve anything. I didn't deserve anything but the hostility and provocation that was directed, you know, my way. But that never changed me. The shaming and the yelling and the screaming and, you know, people driving their cars at us, that confirmed the narrative that I was taught from the time I was a child, that outsiders were evil and going to hell. The people who changed my mind and turned me from somebody who was actively doing harm to other people to now an advocate for grace and for equality and compassion, they were people who had compassion on me, who took into account the fact that I had been indoctrinated into this belief system from the time I was old enough to understand words. And their willingness to reach out to me is what changed things. So now, not only am I doing the work to try to help these people that Westboro targets and groups like them, but I'm not now actively doing those things. So it's like there is a lot of good that can come out of reaching out to people in these groups.
And as we talk about this book, we should let listeners know there's some tough language in here because of the nature of what Westboro Baptist Church still does. Things that we're going to use some of that language here in this conversation. Tell me the first time people start bringing signs to, you know, you're like 5 years old when you're, you know, you're on the picket line, and those signs, you have your favorite signs. Tell me what some of your favorite signs were as a child.
Oh, man.
Because you're 5 years old now.
Yeah, I mean, some of the earliest signs we were using were, gays are worthy of death. And then, you know, eventually we got to what has become their most famous message, which is God hates fags. that's their website. You know, there's a lot of really, you know, terrible language that I was taught, you know, from the time I was a kid, that this is how we should be talking about people who are abominable in the sight of God. So we were taught that this was not our hatred. This was the hatred of God, and that in fact it was a loving thing for us to go out and warn people that they were doing wrong.
To rebuke.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
What is the nature of rebuking? Right. And the word fag is used because it specifically talks about something that is fuel for hell.
Right.
So this is a stick that burns, and therefore...
Right, a literal,
is a literal thing to say, this is what needs to happen to you. This is what's happening to those who have died.
Right, yeah. A literal faggot is used to fuel the fires of nature. It's used for kindling. And so we use that word as, you know, saying that, you know, there are passages in the New Testament that talk about gays, how they burn in their lust one toward another, and then fuel the fires of God's wrath and fuel the fires of hell. So using that language even was considered essential by the church, because they said gay was a misnomer.
You go to school, you read books, you go to the library, you watch television, you're in the school, there's a teacher who's Jewish, you have things to say about that, but you have friends. A lot of people think that in order for this there's some compound somewhere where, you know, there's nothing is let in or let out, but it's, this culture is permeable. I mean, you move freely between the two cultures.
Yes, absolutely. And that, it's something that I think people have a hard time understanding, like, how could you be exposed to these ideas and not be changed by them? And the only way I can answer that is by explaining, you know, the experience of being at home with people that I loved and who every single day was, you know, where we were reading the Bible together, talking about current events and things that were happening in the world in light of the church's understanding of Scripture, and being constantly told about outsiders, how these people hate each other, they hate God, you know, so even as we are being exposed to them, we have already been, you know, the analogy that I use is that it's like being inoculated against those ideas and any reaching out by those people because they are evil. The mindset is so black and white, it is so us versus them, that there was just, I could not see outside of it, until I got on Twitter.
Let's talk about Twitter, and let's talk about social media, because the New Yorker did a column about World AIDS Day, and your tweet is, and everything's highlighted in red on World AIDS, and yours is, thank God for AIDS. That's how you're using. So how do you kind of come into the world of social media and Twitter and see, at first, the power to spread the Westboro message even further, and then let's transition into how other people see it as an opportunity to invite you into a different mindset?
Westboro is extremely active. So the reason people think that it's actually only a group of about 70 to 80 people, but people have this, you know, image of them as being kind of larger than life because they're all over the place. We were actively going, you know, traveling across the country. We picketed every single day for a couple of hours in my hometown, Topeka, Kansas. But any tool that we could find to spread this message, because again, we thought this was loving our neighbor. So it was all consuming, the desire to spread this message. And so when I read an article about Twitter, I thought, okay, well, this is something else that I can do. And at that point I was like 22, 23. So this is someplace we can go to spread this message. And because of the nature of Twitter, you know, you get on and, you know, it doesn't take very long. You're limited to, at that point, it was 140 characters. And Westboro's message, it is tailored for something like Twitter. We used 3 to 5 words on a picket sign. You know, so 140 characters was actually quite a bit more. So I got on there, you know, spreading that message, and it immediately got a lot of attention and a lot of hostility, which is exactly the kind of response that I had expected, because it was the same response that I'd gotten on the picket line all my life. And then almost immediately, like it shocks me now looking back, because yes, you mentioned World AIDS Day, so that's December 1st. I got on Twitter in 2009, so that's December 1st, 2009, was a few months after I started tweeting for the church. And even at that point, I had already started having these conversations that would eventually change my heart and mind and help me see outside of this paradigm that I had been taught was unquestionable, the literal and infallible word of God that could not be doubted. And so anyway, so I started having these conversations, and initially it is universally, you know, full of that kind of hostility and provocation. And but almost immediately people started to see that I was sincere, that I really believed. You know, I would be constantly quoting the Bible and saying, you know, this is the truth of God. You know, we have no standing to question this. And so then they started asking questions. And over time, you know, the fact that, you know, there were several things about Twitter that made it different from anything that I'd encountered before. It allowed me to develop rapport with people over time, even though, because it was in this very limited way, 140 characters at a time, you know, I felt safe. And I could be vulnerable in a way that I could never be in physical space with other people, because I'd had all these experiences with people. I knew to keep them at arm's length, and interacting with them online, you know, again, it made me feel safe. That distance made me feel like there was some kind of a buffer zone, kind of. And then there was several other things about Twitter. The fact that it was 140 characters meant that the very, you know, the insults that my family constantly and casually tossed around all the time, on the picket line, in email, there wasn't space for it. And so that's one part of it. Like, there wasn't space for it, so I just had to stop using them. But there was another aspect to it, which was that when I did include those insults, there was this immediate feedback loop where I could see the conversation immediately go off the rails, because now we're no longer talking about this theological point that I think is so important. Now this is a playground quarrel, and, you know, people are saying, you don't know me, and, you know, getting really defensive. And so that was frustrating to me, because again, I thought this was so important. It was so valuable. They needed to hear the truth of God. And so all of these things changed the dynamic of the conversation, and that was instrumental in outsiders being able to understand Westboro's ideology with enough nuance to find these internal inconsistencies and contradictions in our theology. My family is full of lawyers. You know, my grandfather was a civil rights pioneer in the state of Kansas, and he required his children and their spouses to go to law school to support him in that work. He got an award from the NAACP and other black civil rights groups, and was kind of the go-to lawyer in those situations. They are not stupid, and they are not deliberately doing what they know is wrong. They are just convinced by these arguments. So I had never, growing up, you know, there was always an answer for everything that we, you know, all the positions that we took. There was always a verse, a Bible verse, that we would, you know, memorize. And, you know, having these arguments on, you know, on the picket line, I never had the sense of, you know, there was always an answer for everything. So I was just certain that we were right. So when these people on Twitter were able to find these contradictions, it was mind-blowing to me. It was the first time in my life that I realized that we could be wrong about something. And it's sort of, you know, the image of Westboro as having, you know, a monopoly on truth, this divine, unquestionable truth. When I came to doubt that in my mind, that was the beginning of the end for me at Westboro.
I want to talk about courage, because as you leave and form a life, and a lot of that, it happens right here in South Dakota, right here in the community of Deadwood, you have choices now. You can change your name and be someone else and leave all this behind. You could oppose your family. You could be a counter-protester. You could help people infiltrate and understand and bring down, you know, depending on what. And instead, you choose to do what you're doing, which is, I mean, this book is going to be huge. I think everybody knows that. And have these difficult conversations. And in doing that, you're going to have to face-to-face people who still believe the old message and who are angry with you and want to argue with you. You will have to face people whose lives you have damaged. So I don't think it's any secret for people who listen to the show that I'm a veteran. Westboro protests veterans' funerals pretty ardently. Mm-hmm. When I'm 5 years old, people are calling my older brother a faggot, throwing things at his head. You and I have to sit down together, and I have to say, your words hurt my family and have affected my family's lives in ways that you'll never understand. And you're brave enough to do that with not just me, but anybody else who's gonna come find you and ask you those questions. One, what do you say to those people? And two, where do you find the courage to not just say, I'm done, I'm out, this is my new life, I'm young, I got lots of life ahead of me. Talk about courage first.
So there was a moment a few months after I left Westboro, and I was in, you know, there was one of the gentlemen that I met on Twitter, became a friend. He was an Orthodox Jew living in Jerusalem. He invited me to this Jewish cultural festival, the Jewlicious Festival, in California, a few months after I left. He was the one who found the first contradiction in the church's ideology. And sitting, you know, and having these conversations, we were sitting at the Shabbat table of a rabbi who, you know, him and his family, my sister had held a sign that said, your rabbi is a whore, 3 years earlier at this exact festival. And, you know, I was sitting there weeping with my sister and talking to David about everything that we had lost. Our family, you know, the only life we'd ever known, our lifelong home. It felt like we had betrayed everything and everyone that we'd ever loved. And we were just terrified. And he said, in a lot of ways, leaving Westboro Baptist Church was the most Westboro Baptist Church thing you could have done. He said, they were the ones, he said, you are your parents' children. They were the ones who taught you to stand up for what you believe in, no matter what it cost you. They just never imagined you'd be standing up to them. I knew, you know, I did know about, you know, your being a veteran, and I understand the pain that we have caused so many people. The idea of walking away from that and of trying to pretend like it didn't happen, all the things that I did as a member of Westboro, and of not trying to make amends and make it right, it never occurred to me because of that upbringing. And that's, I mean, I can only say that it's anything in me, I feel like anything in me that's good is a reflection, or courageous, or whatever word that you want to use, is also a reflection of the family. And a hope that, you know, you can see both sides of that by when you read this book, or, you know, it's complicated because humans are complicated. I don't believe that my family are bad people. I think they do incredibly destructive and in some cases even evil things. I do believe that the funeral protests especially, I do believe those things, that was and is evil. But I know that they do it because they were just like me. They were indoctrinated from the time they were. The vast majority of them grew up in the church. And in a lot of ways, their upbringing was even more extreme than mine was, even though the picketing didn't start until I was five. They were taught that those ideas were unquestionable. And now the hope that I have for them is that it's not that, you know, I understand why people demonize them. And I just understand that the things that changed me were compassion and empathy and grace, even when I seemed most not to deserve it. And I hope that will change them too.
Would you say that the courage that you have came from your family, but you decided how to use it?
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your life now, because it's pretty heavy right there. Tell me about your family, your kids. Tell me the fun things. Like, what do you enjoy about living right now? Because it's important for us to be in this space, and so many people are in this space with us. And now let's exhale and say, you know, we're also a couple of moms having a conversation about, you know, our kids and our siblings, some of, you know, whom you are in touch with and some not.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about Megan today.
Well, today is my daughter's first birthday, and she is just the joy of my life. Everything. I mean, I can't believe I grew up at the church, you know, since the church is mostly my family. I came to believe that I would never get married or have children. And so now to have this wonderful husband who you will also read about in the book, he was one of the people that I met on Twitter who helped change my mind. And so to have him and our daughter is just a wonderful, wonderful thing that I'm so grateful for. I feel like I don't deserve, you know, any good thing. I mean, I deeply have that feeling. And so the fact that...
I disagree with that.
Thank you. But
I believe that you're worthy.
Thank you.
Maybe you need to hear that a bunch of times from a bunch of different people.
I mean, it just makes me feel so much gratitude for every good thing that is in my life and every good person. So,
what kind of mother are you to her? Because your mother is incredibly affectionate and loving, and yet sometimes not the person that you want to stand up and defy. Tell me what kind of mom that you are and want to be as your child grows.
There is a lot about my mother that I want to be for my daughter. You know, when I got pregnant, there was definitely a part of me that felt like I could just kind of go very inward and you know, slow down, you know, and try not to do too much and things like that. And then I thought about my mom. My mom, you know, I'm the third of 11 children. And so, you know, my mom was constantly pregnant when I was growing up. And she would, you know, she got morning sickness and had all the problems that, you know, any, you know, pregnant woman has. And, you know, she would be giving me my walking orders, going around the house, telling me all the things that I needed to get done. Pause 1 second, go and vomit, and then come back. And I mean, and she just, nothing slowed her down. And I absolutely want to, you know, be that same kind of example for my daughter. One thing that I have to, like, have, you know, in my own mind all the time is that, you know, I'm not raising her to be my daughter or a member of a church or some, I'm raising her to be her own person, and she's going to have to grow up and live her own life.
The book is called Unfollow, A Memoir of Loving and Leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. My guest has been the very brave and talented Megan Phelps Roper. I love you. Thank you for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org and on our daily podcast, In the Moment Segments. The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow Lori on Twitter at @MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Chris Loughrey. Thanks for listening.